This April, the small nonprofit is being sponsored by Troy Mailing. That's T-R-O-I Mailing. Friends, I've personally been using Troy's printing and mailing services for almost 5 years now. I choose them for my clients, and I chose them when I was in-house. They are great to work with, always get my brand colors right, are cost-effective, and get my mailouts to my donors on time, even during busy seasons. Call 1-866-876-4624 for a free $100 postage credit when you use promo code DONORDM1 on your next campaign. Thank you, Troy Mailing, for sponsoring the small nonprofit.
Welcome to the Small Nonprofit Podcast with down-to-earth practical advice on how to get things done in your small organization. You are going to change the world and we can help. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Anya McGlynn.
Hello, everyone.
Anya, I'm really excited about today's interview. The topic of anti-oppression has long been on our radar, having worked in the sector for so long, but it's really meaningful and helpful to really take a step back and unpack the language and the process and the actions that we can take and what it means to live and work towards anti-oppression today.
Yeah, absolutely. Today's guest is someone that I've had the opportunity to know very well. Here's my little disclaimer. I am on the board of a theater company called Be Current, and one of our programs is Be Inc. It's anti-oppression training for cultural producers and other community groups as well. And today's guest, Rania El-Mugomar, is our facilitator. So that's just a little disclaimer, but that's not to say that you know, we're just paying lip service to her work or anything. She's an incredible educator and
she's
advocate.
The best. Yeah. I'm so looking forward to sharing what she has to say with our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of my key takeaways from all of the conversations that I've had with Rania and from today's in particular is this notion of being aware that the system that we all work and live in and in some cases feel oppression as a result of. Is a system that was very specifically designed to elevate some and to debase others. And when you think about something having been designed, you have to think about undoing it by the same kind of design process. Mm-hmm. So I think Rania uses this great concept called designing for liberation, which I hope that you all hold on to and start to think about what that means for your day-to-day work.
Mm-hmm. And what I love about Rania and how she talks about the work that we all need to do is that it's so practical and so explicit and specific. Mm-hmm. There's no guesswork, right? No. Once we can learn to let go of some of our own stuff, there's a really clear path forward. Yeah. And she tells her own stories and gives her own examples, but I think it's very clear how we can all do better around anti-oppression.
Absolutely. You know, some of the things that you'll hear her talk about are how to do community consultation with the groups that you're purporting to serve and how to do that in a way that promotes liberation rather than replicates or recreates oppressive structures. Mm-hmm. So listen out for that too, especially for those of our listeners who are doing work with marginalized communities.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. I really don't want to take up any more time before you listen to this interview. So let me introduce Rania. Rania El-Mugomar is a Sudanese artist, anti-oppression consultant, and liberation educator based in Toronto. Rania's artistic and community work is deeply rooted in Black liberation, and Rania is a published writer, award-winning organizer, speaker, arts educator, and multidisciplinary performer. We love her. She's the best. Here's our interview. Rania, welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. We're really excited about this conversation because it really feels like it's underlying a lot, well, should underlie a lot of work, all the work that we're doing in our sector, which is an anti-oppression framework and how we take these ideas, how do we learn what these ideas are and turn them into action. So I thought we could start with a bit of sort of language definitions or understanding, almost a glossary of what we're talking about when we say anti-oppression or diversity or inclusion, and how those fit together. Can you walk us through some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm going to first walk through the equality, equity, anti-oppression spectrum, and then I'll talk a little bit about why I'm allergic to diversity. Okay?
Love it.
So I think often, you know, people get introduced to this kind of work of justice through this idea of equality. And I think that's pretty natural. When we're little, we care about fairness, right? Mm-hmm. You talk to kids, it's usually a really good gateway actually to have these conversations with your children is to start from fairness. So we kind of tend to understand why things are unfair, you know? Somebody's got more apples than me. It seems upsetting. And as a result, we seem to think that equality means that everyone gets the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that is that it begins from the assumption that everyone is the same and everyone needs the same thing and everyone is starting from the same place. So the problem for me with equality is that it doesn't actually take into account the already existing power dynamics that mean that even if I give everybody 10 apples, that's not going to land the same way when someone already has a reserve of 1,500 mm-hmm. apples and someone has never had apples before or has a family of 20 to feed.
Right.
So for me, the problem with equality, if give everybody the same thing, is that it actually centers a quite a privileged group of people in the middle from whom we decide how many people need apples and what kind of apples they need and how many of those apples do they need. So the problem with it doesn't take into account people's unique needs and experiences. Mm-hmm. Then we move on to equity. Equity is a practice. Equity is a tool. For me, equity has always been the work of harm reduction. Equity is give everyone what they need. Okay?
Right.
So with equity, we might come into a space and realize that actually some people need 10 apples, other people need protein, other people need access to dry goods, so on and so forth. And as a result, we begin to give everyone what they need in order to survive and thrive. Mm. But the problem with equity is that it always tells you, okay, work around the barriers, work around the barriers, work around the barriers. Mm. Okay. With anti-oppressive practice or liberation, it tells you, listen, it is actually possible to take the barriers down. Mm-hmm. It says you don't have to stop doing the work of equity. The work of equity is the work of harm reduction. And when we bring the barriers down, I would like for so many of us to survive to see that. Mm. So we do the work of equity to make sure that people are surviving and thriving in the meantime. Mm. Now, liberation tells you simultaneously, you can absolutely break down those barriers, those systemic barriers, and put something else in their place. Mm-hmm. So for me, the challenge, I think, with a lot of these conversations is we don't spend a whole lot of time imagining what is the thing that goes in its place.
Right.
Say you smash the system, okay?
Yeah.
Say you smash the patriarchy. What happens now?
Right. Right. What's the other hierarchy that takes its place?
Yeah. And then does it have to be a hierarchy? You know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a challenge for all our imaginations. We spend a lot of time critiquing and problematizing, which is all nice and lovely, but what does it look like if we design liberation? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, design is always a big part of the conversation because there's a sense that we don't know how we got here.
Right.
Which is, it couldn't be farthest from the truth. It's the most well-documented recipe sure. in history.
Yep.
Often people will tell me, oh, Rania, you know, I really admire your work. You try to understand how, you know, the world came to be this way. And I'm like, it's the farthest thing from what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We understand. Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out how to undo all of it.
Yeah, exactly. 500 years of a colonial project has pretty much laid out the path.
Absolutely. And I mean, when you look at it, this is a recipe for which the ingredients are, you know, patriarchy and colonialism and racism and capitalism and ableism and cishet normativity, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. All of the isms come together to make this hideous stew that nobody wants to eat. Mm-hmm. So as we're thinking about this, anti-oppression tells you, listen, you can do this by design since all of these things were designed with a great deal of intention. Mm-hmm. For certain people to survive them and thrive in these conditions and without even consideration for the survival of other people beyond them being used as tools in that system.
Right.
So yeah. It tells you, anti-oppression tells you, listen, it's possible to do this intentionally, and it's possible to design intentionally with all kinds of people surviving and thriving in mind. Mm-hmm. So that the big thing about anti-oppression is, yes, it's a framework, but it's actually a thing that you do. Mm. It's a practice. Mm-hmm. And it's anchored deeply by a practice of intersectionality, which I'll get into a little bit later. But
yeah,
anti-oppression is not a theory. Please. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, in the same way that, like, we talked about social innovation on this podcast as well, and like that also is not an outcome; it's a process as well, right? And it's something that has to be practiced, and like, you know, you have to continually sort of work on your muscle. And in the same way, it sounds like anti-oppression is continual. It's not a thing that's over. It's woven into almost everything that we do.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that idea of this is not diversity, because I think that a lot of people still think of this as diversity. And how do we move people from that language and that thinking that it's about representation to understanding that this is about systems and breaking down those systems and processes? And on top of that, the other term that I hear a lot of these days is inclusion. And mm-hmm. I think people are moving away from this idea of diversity as tokenism, which it sounds like it really is, to what does it mean to include people? Mm-hmm. And how does that fit within the anti-oppression process?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, diversity is one of those words that I hear and I just get tense. Mm-hmm. It bothers me a lot because for Canada, it's actually part of a very well-defined project of multiculturalism for which there are policies, mm-hmm. federal level directives, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. The problem with this is it's about optics largely. Okay. In a city like Toronto, that is, according to our census, 51% quote unquote visible minority, even though people seem to be confused about what the word minority means. However, mm-hmm. You are going to walk into a lot of rooms and they're going to be diverse. Okay, by no intention, by no design, by no...
Just by default.
Yeah, just diversity is a thing that happens, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly when the pool of people you're drawing from is largely diverse. The problem with diversity is it doesn't take into consideration often the overlapping analysis of power structures, right? So often I come into an organization and my client will tell me, well, we've got a lot of women and people of color in our staff. And I'm like, cool, here, we're going to play a really horrible game. You're going to cut out everybody's photos from their ID badges. And you're going to make a little pyramid. And you're going to put people in terms of who they report to and in the institutional hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And watch that pyramid get whiter and more male as it gets to the top.
Yeah.
So the problem with it is when we don't have an overlapping analysis of power structures on top of understanding who's diverse, it ends up with this shallow diversity. I don't want the diversity to be as deep as a puddle. I want to understand the non-visible markers of people's identities. I want a diversity of experiences and opinions and capacities. I want dissenting voices to be included because those dissenting voices are the voices that push for change. I want support, sustainable support for the diverse people who end up working in these institutions and organizations, because I hear so often is we have such high turnover of X, Y, or Z. And I'm like, yeah, because people come here and people are saying all sorts of transphobic nonsense to them, so they leave. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or they see that in the work, their particular community is not really being prioritized in meaningful ways, and so they leave. Or they see that there is indeed a glass ceiling that which white women can pass through, but they cannot pass through. And they are often left behind to clean up the shards of that ceiling when it is smashed. Yeah. So there is, for me, diversity can be used to actually silence and tokenize people. Mm-hmm. Is, well, we're doing the work. Look how diverse we are. But with no critical self-reflection, both as individuals and then as an institution. So for me, diversity is a problem. I also find inclusion troubling. I mean, mm-hmm. who's including who and in what? Mm-hmm. And do I want to be included in your nonsense? Okay, like, probably not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The problem with it is I shift to a conversation around meaningful inclusion. And even then, whenever we talk about a concept, we can talk about its shortfalls and the ways that it just doesn't quite encompass what we're trying to do. I think it's fine. We use imperfect language and imperfect concepts all the time, and we just have to name the imperfection as we do it. Mm-hmm. So for me, meaningful inclusion is like this. It's more than a seat at the table, okay? More than a seat at the table is the analogy I use often and is now anybody I've trained or has worked with me, I think, has used it. So you might have heard it elsewhere by now. But it is, say we're having a dinner party, okay? And we pick our table settings, we pick our food, we pick the time, we pick the location, and we invite a bunch of people. That's inclusion, okay? I've invited a bunch of people. I am including them in my dinner party. Right. The problem is I don't want to be included as an afterthought. I want to be part of the design of things. I want to pick our table settings, okay? I want to fold our napkins into opera houses and not swans. Everybody knows that's cuter. I want to choose our food. I like my food spicy. Maybe you don't. Maybe it's Ramadan and I'm fasting. Maybe I eat halal or kosher or vegan or vegetarian or gluten-free. Or I am a diabetic and I need to follow a strict diet. Or your table is too high for my friend in a mobility device. Mm-hmm. Or so on and so forth. Or the place you're having your dinner is inaccessible. The problem is when we invite people as an afterthought, we invite them to ill-fitting tables. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why they can't advance, they can't join, or they just leave.
Yeah.
So for me, the problem is with that is that inclusion has to happen in the design phase.
Right.
Okay. And when we're talking about meaningful inclusion, it means being open to your whole design is not going to work for us. Let's scrap it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So interesting.
Including people in leadership, decision-making capacity, design, evaluation, advisory, yeah, and oversight. Which are, I think, are all very tangible things for not-for-profits to think about. So,
yeah. Can I ask you, yeah, specifically to, sort of to drill down on that design piece, because I love that notion of like that you can design for liberation. And so how would a leader of a small organization, you know, sort of like step one, they're like, okay, you know what, I get that concept. That makes perfect sense to me. Like what is the first place that maybe I should look in terms of my organization, to begin to practice, designing for liberation?
Mm-hmm. I think we have to think about our micro context being our particular institutional history. Mm. A mistake that I see a lot of small organizations do is to start, all of a sudden they're brand new, all of a sudden they have an anti-oppressive framework, not addressing any of the harms and the problems that have happened in the past.
Right.
So the first piece for me would be the critical self-reflection piece, mm-hmm, and looking at your institutional history and reconciling that. Because that's how you build trust with communities, and that's how you get people involved in the design phase. Mm-hmm. So the first place is kind of evaluating what you've done in the past, how it's worked or how it hasn't worked, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the first thing, is reconciling your institutional history and taking a really long, hard look at your micro context. And then the second thing is really quite simple. Inclusion by design tells you take the most marginalized person and design backwards, design for them. Mm. Okay, you go on the outside of the outside. If there's a center in the margins, you go to the margins of the margins. Right. And you look at who's in the margins of the marginals of the particular community you're trying to serve. Mm-hmm. Okay, so say you run programming for queer and trans youth. Mm-hmm. So in the margins of that community are Black trans women, mm-hmm, Black trans women with mental health issues, disabilities, and who may be sex working, mm-hmm, Indigenous Two-Spirit folk, mm-hmm, who may or may not be dealing with mental health issues, who may or may not be living in precarious housing, underhoused, or homeless. So right. If that's where you're... That's really the margin of the community you're trying to serve. You ask yourself, does my programming fit this person? Mm-hmm. Is it accessible to them? Does it make sense for their needs and priorities? Have they been consulted in the design of this program? Or is it someone without any lived experience of any of those, you know, multitude of barriers and embodied identities who's designing the solutions or the interventions?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes we see like, you know, I've seen, you know, in grant making practices, there's more of a focus on like including the community that you're hoping to serve in the process of designing the programs. And I think that that's fantastic. How do you ensure that that's not kind of an exercise in fulfilling a grant requirement, and that, you know, the people who are then, you know, sort of doing that community consultation are trying to, you know, use whatever, you know, empathetic principles of design to understand what that population really needs. And how do you ensure that that's not just an exercise? I feel like, you know, I've you know, heard some instances where it is kind of more of a box to be checked, and that sometimes that, you know, that consultation isn't translated into the programming. And sometimes it's because of a lack of resources, or, you know, that's what it's cited as mm-hmm. How do you make sure that's less of an exercise and really, you know, make sure that those principles are incorporated into the programming?
Mm-hmm. I think there is largely a consultation fatigue in chronically excluded communities, because mm-hmm. we see people come and they ask us about things, and it's not an easy conversation to have. We revisit our traumas. We talk about the difficult experiences that we've had. It's often a triggering experience for people. Mm-hmm. Those consultation processes, and then people will then go and they'll be able to say, well, we've done 3 community consultations.
Yeah.
And then the problem is often actually lies partially with the grant system. Mm-hmm. We take our ideas and, well, they don't make sense for the grant application, and we actually make a program to fit the grant application,
right?
Rather than get funding and support for the program we know needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that to an extent, because, you know, I spent 5 years managing a small not-for-profit, and I understand the challenges of like being sustainably funded.
Mm-hmm.
But what that means largely is that we get money to cover our bottom line, to pay our staff if we have any, and to somewhat do some kind of programming that has terrible retention rates for its participants, and is not really making any kind of an impact, and has been running in one dress or another for like 40 years.
Yeah.
To me, this is such an interesting conversation, because I think it speaks to some of the same things you were describing around diversity, but I want to call it lip service, which is, you know, and I want to go back to that micro context self-reflection piece, because I think that this is where a lot of organizations get stuck. You make it sound very easy, but I think it's actually a really difficult process for organizations and people within organizations to be self-reflective. And I think until we can get that piece right, a lot of it is going to come out as lip service or sort of surface engagement without the deep and meaningful change. So how do we talk, how do you talk to others, or how do you think for yourself around your own position and your organization's history? And, you know, these are big things you're putting on the table, and it's really scary. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of labor. And I think a lot of organizations don't do that in a meaningful way. So how do we deep dive there to begin
mm-hmm.
with?
Mm-hmm. I think first it's about really being honest with yourself about your areas of influence and control.
Mm-hmm.
I think we come with a big set of promises for things that are not even under our control. Like mm-hmm. we make big promises in our work plans and our grants to the communities we serve about how we are going to substantially improve this and decrease that. And there's no real like metric for measuring most of these things, either quantitative, qualitative, or anecdotal.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. I think often we have really good intentions, but these are communities that are also sick of everybody's good intentions. You know, their good intentions, they're not paying my bills, they're not paying my rent, they're not keeping my kids fed, they're not, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so for that critical self-reflection piece, I think it's being really okay to saying we messed up. I think there's a big culture here, particularly in the West, where being wrong is like the worst thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that we'd rather just dig our heels into being wrong and continue to hurt people rather than acknowledge that we were wrong.
Oof, there's
a big resource here we have that I developed called The Anatomy of an Apology. Which I will share, and I don't mm-hmm. know if there's a way that we can link people to it. But it's actually probably been shared something close to 3 million times in print and digitally.
Yeah.
Because I'm in my personal life, I'm blessed to have a lot of really remarkable friendships. And one of my friendships is my best friend is somebody who checks off every box. I always tell him, Dave, the world was designed for you. Yes, he absolutely checks off every box. He's white, tall, conventionally handsome, blonde hair, blue-eyed, able-bodied, cisgendered. straight, university educated, middle class.
Wow.
You know, and his name is Dave. Like, it's the world is made for Dave. Yeah. And actually, my friendship with Dave has taught me that you can have a whole lot of privilege and a whole lot of power and still choose empathy.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave is fond of, I'm sorry you feel that way. Okay. Mm-hmm. So one day I was like, we're not doing this anymore.
That old chestnut. Yeah.
And so I developed this resource called the Anatomy of an Apology. And I thought about really like, how did I learn to apologize meaningfully? And that's by hurting people, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I felt that, okay, some of that labor could absolutely go towards making this like open source public resource for people to like think about reconciling some of the harms I've done in my life and I continue to do as a person. Wow. And so it goes a little bit like this. I'll walk you through kind of the big tenets of an apology. The first is acknowledgement, bearing mm-hmm. witness. Okay. We live in a world that gaslights marginalized communities, gaslighting being a gender-based violence term that refers to a psychological or emotional abuse tactic whereby your abuser either A, repeatedly presents you with false information, or B, repeatedly questions your perception of your reality, that you begin to center their version of the world, their mm-hmm. perception of reality. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we do this to each other in all kinds of relationship dynamics, but also we do this institutionally to communities. We tell communities the problem is with you.
Mm-hmm.
You need to work harder, try harder, do this, do that. And we fail to acknowledge that we are actually part of the systemic oppressions and barriers that people face. Mm-hmm. So as a result, there's often a lack of naming of the things we do to people, both as individuals working inside these organizations, but as institutions themselves. So acknowledgement, naming that this thing happened is actually remarkable. One of the things that people often report when they're experiencing microaggressions and also experiencing oppressive behaviors, they look around them and it felt like nobody saw that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I want to talk or just add to that from my experience, which is it's not about intentions. I think a lot of people get caught up in like, well, I didn't intend for that feeling or for that outcome, and therefore that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where what you're saying, which I think is so important, which is acknowledge that the impact is there regardless of the intention.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think this leads like really well into like some of those other elements of the apology of this idea of an intent versus impact, right?
Mm-hmm.
The next part of the apology is emotional uptake. Okay. Emotional uptake is when you look at a person or a community and you acknowledge that their feelings, whatever feelings they're feeling, are valid mm-hmm. for whatever duration of time they feel them, at whatever intensity they feel them. Okay, so not dismissing people's emotion. It is the exact opposite of, I'm sorry you feel that way. Okay, it is, you're entitled to feel your feelings, the emotion that you name, as long as you feel it. Not, oh, you know, if I were you, I'd be more upset than anything. And like, oh, we're sorry that this community took offense to X, Y, or Z. None of those things, right?
Yeah.
So being conscious and giving people the emotional uptake, so taking up people's emotions and considering them to be valid and not policing them on their appropriateness, intensity, or duration.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is the piece that you touched on, which is centering the hurt, okay? You are not the person who's hurt in that situation. You may feel guilty, okay, but that's not the same as experiencing harm.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're centering the hurt, we have to set aside our feelings of guilt and all the I didn't mean to's and I'm not normally like this and that my best friend is black and all of that has to go away. Okay.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I think that is huge and something I know I've personally struggled with and I see a lot of people struggle with. And I think that's something that I just want our listeners to really hear that. And I've gone through it myself where I've, you know, done something that, has been hurtful to someone else. And I felt hurt when I was called out on it. And you have to let it go.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think something that's really critical about this is when you're apologizing to someone, a person or a community, individually or institutionally, do they have to hold your hand, cheer for you, coach you, and reassure you that you're not a horrible person throughout the entire course of that apology?
Oh, man.
Right?
Yeah.
Like you don't get to hurt people and then spend the entire afternoon talking about your feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's excellent. I can't wait actually to look at the anatomy of an apology more in depth. I think there's a lot to learn there. One of the things, you know, Cindy, you sort of talked about sort of, you know, calling people out and the hurt that they can feel, and it can be sort of an awkward, tense conversation. And I think, you know, Rania, I'd love if you could sort of speak to what it means to call somebody out or call somebody into the work of, you know, of liberation when there's a significant power imbalance. So, you know, if you are a manager and, you know, you are experiencing sort of oppression coming down from your boss or if you're the executive director or from the board, you know, how do you have that conversation when you are feeling that really acute sense of power imbalance? And how do you, you know, make sure that, like, in having that conversation, you know, you're not overly re-traumatizing yourself, and that you're creating space to sort of hold your own hurt, but also to give the opportunity for active learning to happen on the part of someone who has hurt you. Realize that's a really difficult question, but I'm sure that you have some thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. I think it's a great question. I think first, I always ask myself, is it my job to really call out this person or call them in? Mm-hmm. And it's always your job to quote unquote collect your people. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what that means is people who will laterally share a privilege with mm-hmm. you, laterally share a power, whether institutional or social. Mm-hmm. It's your job to collect those people.
Right. Okay?
Mm-hmm. As a cisgendered person, it is my job to address instances of transphobia because I can do so from a relatively detached place. Mm-hmm. I won't have to re-experience harm that I've experienced in my own life to do so. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
It is not the job of the one trans person in an organization to be the person to address every instance of transphobia.
Right.
So I think when we're talking about, you know, calling people out or in who inside an institutional hierarchy are in a position of direct power or mm-hmm. authority over you, mm-hmm. there has to be a mechanism for that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So first, the first thing that needs to happen for an organization is to normalize these kinds of conversations so that people don't feel quote unquote attacked mm-hmm. when you have a conversation like that with them. Okay.
Right.
We have to remember that calling in or calling out is actually a transformative justice practice. Okay. It is rooted deeply, deeply in the idea that nobody is disposable and that punishing people is not the way we should go about things. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when we think about that largely as a framework, we think about the fact that if you practice transformative justice as a person, as an individual, as a community, as an organization, people know they won't be disposed of. People know what is happening in a call out is an invitation to do better.
Right.
Okay. So as a result, people are far more likely to own their mistakes. If I make a mistake and I know that if I own it, I'm going to be cast out. Mm-hmm. I'm way less likely to be like, yeah, I did that thing. I'm going to sit here and like try to justify it and defend it and redress it, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But if I know that this is not about throwing you away, it's I know because it's A, I love you and I know you can do better, or I know you're smarter than this, or I know you have the capacity to be more empathetic or understanding for to be able to grasp this. So mm-hmm. really calling out or calling in is about self-accountability with community support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah.
So I always think of this as I want to be accountable not only to who I am now, but to the person that I want to be. Mm. Okay. So as an institution, we think about who do we want to be as an organization? That's right. Who we need to be accountable to. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the metric in which I measure my actions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So being able to do that call in is really, if we understand that it's not about me, it's not a personal attack. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's about knowing that you have the capacity to do better than that. And when you get called in, I think we often tell people, how do you call people out? But we don't say what you should do when you get called out or called in.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Take a minute, first of all, okay, before you have an urge to respond to anything. Okay.
Yeah, like take that deep breath.
Absolutely. And my thing is I count backwards from 10 because that's actually psychologically helps you de-escalate. Mm-hmm. So I count backwards from 10 and then I sit and I think, okay, what are the things that are immutably true here? I hurt someone. I could see someone very in front of me is hurt. Mm-hmm. And I can definitely say, I'm so very sorry I hurt you and mean that. even if in that moment I can't quite grasp how my actions are hurtful.
Okay? Right. Yep.
And I can say, I think I need some time to reflect on this. I really appreciate you taking the time and the energy to share that with me. I know that wasn't easy, and I'm not sure that I fully grasp it, and I'd like an opportunity to do that, and can we talk about this again? Mm-hmm. So sometimes when somebody's calling me in, I either A, don't agree, or don't quite understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And I either want to some time to sit with it, talk to some people I trust, and consult with my people to see if did I really mess up in some way that I can't see, or to see that, okay, maybe this person misunderstood me, or just to figure out where the issue is, right, and then to come back to the conversation. I think we have the urge to be defensive if we feel we have to respond immediately. And that's often the case for organizations, right? It's like you do some public harm, you get called out, whether you have allegations of abuse, for example, in an organization.
Yeah.
And we don't stand, we would never tolerate something like this. It's at odds with our values. And we just put out a press release that's detached and doesn't give anybody any kind of emotional uptake, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where in light, we could put a placeholder press release out there being like, you know, this has come to our attention. We see that there's a lot of people who have been hurt. And we want to take the time to understand this and then engage with our community in a meaningful way.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a really important piece of advice and learning there. The placeholder press release, or the request for time to consider the hurt, you know, and I think that's critical. Instead of, you know, having a knee jerk defensive, you know, circle the troops reaction, you know, that I think you're right in signaling that people will give you the opportunity and the space to do reflection if you ask for it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really key piece of advice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk for a minute about what you were saying before, and I'm going to call it allyship, which is, mm-hmm. you know, we can't always, it's not the work of someone who is experiencing oppression to always be calling out that oppression. And so how can we, as people at various places within positions, within power, be an effective ally and take action when we see this happening, even though we're not at the receiving end of that oppression?
Mm-hmm. So I think often there's two strands here. There's the bystander intervention strand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's like the being an ally as a practice in your life and as a part of your politics and your values. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So often people are asking about the bystander intervention because in that moment we have that, you know, fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And as is the person who's experiencing that harm. Okay. Mm-hmm. My first thing is that let's say that whether it's happening on the subway to someone you've never met before or whether it's happening to your coworker, you use that center the hurt principle of the apology as well. Mm-hmm. You go to the person who's being harmed and you check in with them. Okay. Because often either someone will turn into an object lesson. I'm a Black woman. I do not want to be the object lesson between two white people having a moral argument.
Oh, God.
Okay. I really don't want that. Okay. At all. So as a result, I would, if I'm experiencing some kind of racism or racial microaggression, that again, the same thing that the anatomy of an apology teaches us is we stop and we bear witness. Hey, I saw that. That wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you okay? Right. Do you want to talk to them? I can come with you. Do you want me to talk to them? Do you want me to leave it alone?
Yeah.
Do you want me to come with you? We can talk to a manager or a board member, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. When you're an ally and you don't experience a certain kind of oppression because of your privilege in the world, you have a certain position of believability and objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Leverage that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? If I'm saying so-and-so is racist, just like, oh, I'm being sensitive, I'm too close to it, so on and so forth. All of a sudden, Dave jumps in and says, yo, I really heard that person say some racist things. Oh, if Dave said it, it must be true. Okay.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's so,
yeah.
It's problematic, but we have to leverage the power that we have access to inside this particular power structure that we all live in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think leveraging our power to support people is really important. Thinking about what power do I have access to and how can I leverage it to support someone in an empathetic, compassionate, and appropriate way. But bearing witness and checking in with people. So something that I see often, I'm a Muslim woman, but I'm not a visibly Muslim woman, i.e. I do not wear the hijab or the niqab or the burqa. Mm-hmm. And I am riding the subway. So most of the Islamophobia that I experience is kind of secondhand. It's being directed at someone else and I happen to be there. And there's this large white man who is towering over this Muslim woman sitting in those two-seater sections and like screaming at her every kind of thing you can imagine that is Islamophobic and awful. Mm-hmm. Everyone is freezing. A bunch of people are watching. No one is doing anything. This is called the bystander effect. It's really well-documented psychological phenomena.
Right.
And my first instinct is, I'm not going to go fight this like 7 foot tall dude, you know, I'm 5 feet tall on a good day. Like I'm not going to get very far. And also I'm not going to go speak to this person because the level of like hatred that they're spewing out, it's not the kind of person where I could have a conversation with them where it's like a slight thing that they didn't know was Islamophobic, and a conversation with them over 5 subway stops might change their mind.
Yeah, it's not going to be productive.
I'm always doing a cost benefit analysis of these situations, right?
Yeah.
So my instinct is actually, okay, center the hurt. I sit next to that person who's experiencing harm. She's still being screamed at. Now we're both being screamed at. Mm-hmm. But I don't even acknowledge the person doing the screaming. I don't make eye contact with them. I don't look their way. I pretend as if they don't exist. I sit next to her and I say, hey, are you okay? Do you want me to get off the subway with you at the next stop and we can get on the next train together? I can ride with you to your stop. Yeah. What would you like to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I notice, of course, as I begin to intervene, that other people are now intervening. Mm-hmm. And like these 4 guys, they read us a bunch of different races, escort him off the train. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now they had been watching the whole time. They didn't really do anything until somebody took that first step. And that's really common in the bystander effect. Mm-hmm. But it also gave that person agency who's experiencing the harm, is that they have agency. And often when you're experiencing microaggressions or oppressive behavior, your agency is being taken away from you. So I don't want to be somebody's savior against their will. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. What do you need? How do you want to be supported?
Yeah.
So bearing witness and checking in.
That's critical. I think, you know, if there's one mantra that I'm taking away here, it's center the hurt, center the hurt, center the hurt. I think that's really critical. And I think in sort of building upon this notion of allyship and, recognizing where you have privilege and calling in or collecting your people. I wonder if you could sort of speak to that notion of privilege actually being contextual, right? That it's not static, and that it moves around depending on who you're with, what context you're in, et cetera, et cetera. So I think some people think that like, yeah, privilege is one thing, it's fixed, and it always exists. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the sort of mutability of it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think that's when we need to rely on intersectionality and positionality to help us understand power. Okay. So intersectionality is 2 things. It's a structural analysis tool and a radical practice. It's coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, but it builds on the work of the Combahee River Collective. So it comes firmly out of the hands of Black feminism, Black mm-hmm. feminist thought. Intersectionality is the reality that we all live a multitude of identities and experiences that are overlapping, and we experience them and embody them simultaneously. Mm-hmm. What intersectionality tells us is then that there's no one universal experience of any identity, because it's always bleeding in and intermingling with other facets of an individual's identity. So my experience of womanhood might look different from somebody else's, right?
Right.
So when we think about intersectionality, it tells you you're embodying a multitude of identities, and sometimes in a particular context, one of your identities is the most relevant thing. And it puts you in a position of relative power or relative disempowerment. And positionality tells you the context matters, that those relationships and those power dynamics shift as the people around you change and the context that you're in changes. Okay. Mm-hmm. An example of this is in a larger, broader Canadian context. I might be a relatively marginalized person as a queer Black immigrant Muslim woman, mm-hmm. but in a larger context, in a Sudanese context, if you were to pluck me from Canada and stick me in the middle of downtown Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan, where I come from, I am one hair away from the top of a very problematic power structure. I am the right shade of black. I'm Muslim. I'm North Sudanese. I have quote unquote good hair. I'm from a high ranking tribe and clan. Mm-hmm. I am from a large urban center. Mm-hmm. The only way that it could be more powerful in that context is if I was a man.
Right.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah.
So being able to name the power that we inhabit in different contexts and understand that it doesn't always translate is really critical to be an ally or an accomplice. Mm-hmm. And what this really means is that those of us with the greatest privileges have the responsibility to take the biggest risks because we are more sheltered from the fallout. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So for a trans person to actively confront transphobia from someone who's transphobic, they risk harm.
Yeah.
Emotional, psychological, physical harm and violence. Mm-hmm. For someone like me, I might get, you know, I might get called some other name. I might get yelled at. I very visibly look like a cis person. Mm-hmm. And that person will just move on. So when we're talking about allyship, it has to be constant. It has to be everywhere. And I really mean that. I don't want you to be the ally who only wants to do the work when it's seen.
Yeah.
Okay? The performative allyship, as we call it. Do you have to be the ally who is in the front of the march yelling things into a megaphone? Are you cool being the person coordinating rides to and from the march?
Right, right, right. And that notion of like sort of expecting reward or, you know, congratulatory praise as well, like to let go of that, I think is really key as well. I think sometimes people want to be, you know, they feel that like they should stand out because of, you know, the way that they have acted as an ally. And
Do you need cookies, gold stickers, trophies,
yeah, cookies, pats on the backs?
Do you need those things? Do you need validation and affirmation?
Yeah.
That you're not one of those fill in the blank.
Yeah. And I think that's really tricky. I mean, you know, I recognize my own privilege and I feel like, you know, I have tried to practice allyship throughout my life. And there have been moments, you know, I think I've come a long way, but certainly when I was younger where I did feel like I wanted to be not necessarily even recognized, but, sort of distinguished from, you know, I guess to put some distance between myself and my inherent, you know, white, middle class educated privilege, right? And I think that if you can sort of confront that sense that you have about yourself, and confront that, oh, you know what, I do want recognition, and it is because I want to distance myself from a particular type, but understanding that it's not important. It's not, you know, it's not helping. To achieve a greater degree of liberation for people who don't have that same kind of privilege.
No, I definitely agree with you. And I think the critical thing that you touched on here is that even if you're not from a place of values like the most problematic people who share laterally your privilege, you still benefit from that privilege.
Of course.
That's the piece that I think is absent for people is that like, I may confront cishet normativity, but I benefit from it constantly. I'm still reaping the interest on that, you know?
Yeah.
So regardless is that we don't live in a void. We're constantly living in this context. So I'm constantly reaping the rewards of that, just as Dave, despite being a lovely person and a great ally, is constantly reaping the rewards of white supremacy and patriarchy. No intention or active labor of his. That's just the world that we live
in. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think that circles really nicely back to what we started talking about, which was that it's that liberation and the systems and practice, that this is ongoing work that we all need to do, and that it's constant improvement. I feel like we could talk forever, but I know that we only have a certain amount of time with our listeners. So I want to just end, Rania, with resources that people can download or access to take steps to move their own work forward in this. Because I think this was a really great foundation for us to say, okay, we understand now. You should have a pretty good understanding of what anti-oppression practice means and how you can start to take action and build that practice into your life.
Definitely. Yeah, there's tons of resources online. The thing that comes to mind that is free and you can download is ArtReach did it maybe like 10 years ago, mm-hmm. Artful Anti-Oppressions, because it really looked at like a small not-for-profit context, mm-hmm. which I think is pretty helpful and tangible for people. They have, I believe, two books on that online that you can download. Mm-hmm. There is Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a white allyship group in, they're kind of a global organization, but they have a Toronto chapter, mm-hmm. Has a lot and a lot of resources around anti-oppressive practice and interpersonal allyship and critical self-reflection that they compile and constantly add to that list. Mm-hmm. So joining their Facebook group is probably the best course of action to get that. And they have an education working group that's constantly producing and compiling resources around that. There's also tons of really amazing facilitators and consultants out there. The big thing that I'll say is nobody expects you to know everything by yourself. Mm. Okay. The big thing is to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe I need to find someone who does, which even as someone who's a quote unquote expert in this field, whatever that means, I have my own consultants formally and informally. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes my consultant is my mom when I can call her, mom, did I mess up? You know, I also have consultants that don't have, you know, I have affiliated consultants who are of trans lived experience, who identify as Indigenous, so mm-hmm. on and so forth, of experiences that where I'm on the side of the oppressor.
Yeah.
In terms of power.
Yeah.
And I accept that there are certain things that I may not be sensitized to, conscious of, or critical enough of. Mm. So as a result, I ask for help when I don't know.
Yeah, that's key.
That's fantastic. And where can we learn more about your work and how people can access your expertise?
You can go to my website, which is www.raniawrites.com, RaniaWrites. Everything is on there. There's tons of workshops. There's free resources, including the Islamophobia Allyship Toolkit, which looks at everything from bystander intervention to institutional practices, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That are free for download that I've developed either by myself or in collaboration with community organizations, as well as the workshops and the events that are happening. There's always free and pay what you can ticket portions mm-hmm. To make sure that there's access for people who may not have the resources but need the knowledge. And then there's contact information if you need further consultation or guidance, and as well as me being able to put you in touch with somebody who knows if I'm not the right person.
Fantastic. Amazing. I want to end on the thought of ask for help. I thought that was a really poignant way to frame all of this, which is, you know, we all need to do work, and the best way to do it is to take action and find resources so you can move forward. So thank you so much, Rania. And thanks to all our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, that's it for today's episode of The Small Nonprofit. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and this show is brought to you by The Good Partnership. As a reminder, if you want more resources around raising more money for your small nonprofit, visit thegoodpartnership.com and download our free fundraising strategy guide. I'll see you next week.